Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we are recording directly from Bruegel annual meetings for a special episode in the backstage of our main plenary room. So if you hear a little bit of background noise, it's because we are in the middle of a coffee break. And I am very pleased for having, for this conversation, Sharon Donnery, who has been a guest speaker at the session just before. Together with Sharon, we are going to speak about the European banking supervision, looking at the current risk assessment and the prospect for the near future. And helping me in co-hosting this conversation is Nicolas Véron, our senior fellow here at Bruegel. So I would like to say hello to Sharon and to Nicolas. I'm going to pass around the microphone.
Well, hi, Giuseppe, and hello to all the listeners. Thanks so much for having me here today. I must say I'm really enjoying being here in Brussels, and particularly, of course, being here at the annual meetings.
And also that's the opportunity for me to thank you, Giuseppe, because you're moving on soon to higher horizons, but you've been such a great colleague at Bruegel that I cannot resist paying tribute to you on this opportunity.
Thank you so much. Our listeners don't know yet that I'm going to leave Bruegel in a few weeks, but there will be time for doing proper goodbyes at the Sound of Economics and give you more tips about it. Just want to remind everyone that Sharon is the Deputy Governor for Financial Regulations in the Central Bank of Ireland, and she is an ex-officio member of the Central Bank Commission and is a member of the Supervisory Board of the European Central Bank and the General Board of the European Systemic Risk Board. So, Nicolas, turning to you, perhaps you can help me to kick off the conversation by looking at how European banking supervision has developed and matured since its startup phase. We have seen supervision has been moving from being predominantly rules-based and heavily codified to one that is more risk-focused and adaptable to a rapidly changing economic environment. So how that has been happening?
Yeah, so supervision is a bit like intelligence gathering. It's a very, it's not secret, but it's not something that happens really under the public glare. Because supervisors have to deal with a lot of information that is confidential and actually is confidential for a good reason. So it's always difficult to judge it from the outside because of this feature. When supervisors screw up, as they did in the US very visibly in March this year with Silicon Valley Bank and a few other cases, then it's in the spotlight and there's a lot of blame going on for good reason. But most of the supervisory activity is about preventing that from happening. So it is difficult to comment on in a public setting. And actually what you said about the evolution of European banking supervision is exactly in that category. European banking supervision, of course, started in November 2014. So that's the kind of first building block of banking union, the single supervisory mechanism. And at the time, they had to go with a lot of processes and data gathering and things that were very administratively heavy. So there's a thing called the Supervisory Review and Evaluation Process, the SREP. We're going to use that acronym in the podcast, which has been reviewed recently. And I would be very keen to hear from Sharon on how the supervisory process in general, but the SREP process in particular, have been evolving of late.
Thanks a lot. So first of all, I think Nicolas has outlined the situation really well. And of course, he's been following these issues for many years, particularly in terms of the establishment of the SSM. Maybe just to start by taking a bit of a step back, and he mentioned the 10 years since the SSM was set up. And of course, there are always things we can improve and adapt, and I'll come back to that. But I think it's really extraordinary, actually, what's been achieved. If you think back to the difficulties that many of us, particularly, for example, in my own country in Ireland, experienced during the financial crisis and how severe and so on that was, and the job of work that we had to do to really enhance the regulatory environment and to build banking supervision on a Eurozone basis. It's really fantastic what has been achieved. A huge amount of work by many people, including our staff, both in the ECB and in the national supervisors. And what do we have now? Well, we have gone from a kind of a somewhat fractured and disparate system of supervision across the Eurozone, where we had different approaches and so on, to one really where we have a much more harmonized and much more integrated approach. And of course, we have banks that are sounder and stronger in terms of their capital ratios, liquidity positions, and so on. That's not to say we can be complacent, because of course there are many risks and challenges ahead, but I think we have done a lot. But of course, as Nicola was alluding to, what got us to here may not be the best also for the future. And it's very important, I think, that we continue to adapt and continue to learn. So for me, the way I think about that is that we have to be efficient. We have very limited resources across the system, and we have to make sure that they're being deployed and used in the most effective way possible. And of course, we have to be effective in delivering on the work that we do, as Nicola was saying, for the citizens and for the economy. And I think that's very much the focus. He mentioned the so-called SREP process and the review that we have had, and that's been published by the European Central Bank. And some of the things that talks about is maybe thinking a bit less about the processes. Of course, they're important and we need to have good processes, but thinking about how we really make them about effectiveness. How do we escalate if we're not getting the sort of traction that we want with a bank? We want a bank to do something, but it's not working very well. And how do we really make sure that we sort of dial up the pressure on that bank? How do we compare banks and learn across the different banks what they can learn from each other, so that overall we can build a sort of more effective approach?
Thank you, Sharon. Nicola, you wanted to add something on that?
Yeah, just following up on this review. So the ECB asked five high-level experienced former or current policymakers to provide an independent look on the SREP process that was published in the spring. Well, one of them dropped off during the exercise, but that happens when people have to pursue their careers. Can you tell us more about what this report added to the thinking within European banking supervision, within the SSM, whether you will implement their recommendations or whether you just take it as an input? And also, frankly, given what has happened in the US with Silicon Valley Bank and the like, how do you see the comparison right now between the SREP process in the Eurozone and EU and what there is in the US, which is the so-called CAMELS rating process and also the stress testing routine, which was largely considered by people like me as a gold standard and the global reference until this year. And now we no longer know where is the lodestar. So can you guide us in that wonkish landscape?
Okay, so I think the first thing to say about the review is I think it's a real positive that the review was undertaken. It commenced, I don't remember exactly when, but over 1 year ago and before the events that happened in the US. And I think it's always really good for central banks, regulators, supervisors to think about reviewing what they do. And as we were talking about earlier, now 10 years on from the establishment of the SSM, it seems like a sort of very good time to think about that. Of course, part of what we wanted to do was hear the views globally, and so we got these experienced supervisors and regulators from around the globe to look at what we were doing. I think very much with this idea of making sure that it's as effective as possible. We know that the banks, for example, I mean, sometimes they don't like the SREP process. There have sometimes been, let's say, complaints, noise about how long it takes, about some of the engagement and so on. So I think this was something important also for us to look at. And the those who undertook the review also engaged, externally with the banks. They engaged with supervisors and various people to get a very broad input into the review. And the review, as you say, is published and people can read it if they like. Oh, no, I think it's a quite interesting read, particularly for those who work in regulation and supervision. But hopefully people find it interesting. But in terms of following up, the report has been, I think, very positively received at the supervisory board and at the ECB more broadly. And of course, it's very important that we take the lessons from that and look at them and think about how we're going to implement them and adapt our supervision. Also because, not just because they're the findings of the review, but also because I think the world around us is changing. We've talked a lot lot at the annual meetings about, you know, the geopolitical complexity, about the monetary policy environment, and so on. Also, we know about the big challenges ahead around digitalization and climate change. And we know that the financial sector is changing. So banks are changing in terms of how they operate, digitization. They're exposed to new risks, cyber risk, for example. We're much more focused now on operational resilience. So the world is changing and we also have to change and adapt in a way, of course, that makes sure we remain focused on the right risks, but also that we're flexible and adaptable. Maybe one other thing to think about the SREP process. There's a lot of other supervisory work done as well. So sometimes there's a lot of focus on the SREP process. So I think one of the things we always have to think about is how not just using capital and liquidity, which are very, very important, but what other tools do we have in terms of, you know, if banks need to address gaps in their operational resilience, if banks need to address issues to do with cyber resilience and so on, how do we make sure that we get traction on those? So thinking about supervision, not just about the SREP process itself, but thinking about supervision in the round in terms of dealing with the other issues as well.
Thank you, Sharon. And you rightly point the accent on risk assessment, which is becoming central in the uncertainty of the global political environment. And perhaps we can go a little bit more in depth into this and see a little bit, help our listeners to navigate those risks. You mentioned a few of them, but maybe we can extrapolate a little bit more about the impact on the banking system. I'm thinking about the war in Ukraine, the rivalry between the United States and China, which are the most obvious examples of geopolitical risks. But there are also others. I mean, you mentioned cyber risks as well and so forth. How we are equipping ourselves in order to manage and navigate this world.
Okay, well, first, maybe to start back, because you mentioned the war in the Ukraine and so on. So I've worked in central banking and regulation for many years. And sometimes I feel that we just go from one crisis to another. So if you take the time period since the global financial crisis, you look at Brexit and all of the complexity and challenges that posed, the pandemic and then the war. I think it tells us something about how the world is changing. Also, I think something that's been very challenging about those crises is how close they are together. And so the gap between them and therefore the opportunity to address some of the challenges that each of those crises pose is also very difficult. And this brings me to something that, again, has been discussed here at the annual meetings about the need for resilience in the system. Now, we're talking here today about the banks particularly and the need for bank resilience, let's say. But I do think this is a much broader issue if you think about economies, if you think about government finances, if you think about household balance sheets, and if you think about other parts of the financial system like non-banks, for example, where we also need to think about how we might build resilience. And now, as you said yourself, of course, the risks also change. So I think whether you're looking at supervision and regulation from a micro point of view, the individual firms, or a macro point of view, looking across the whole system, a key thing we need to be able to do is a really rigorous risk assessment that's also very forward-looking. Because, of course, we've had these big challenges in the past, like the horrendous situation in terms of the war, the pandemic and so on. But we also know that what's ahead of us may not be exactly the same. And so I think a lot of our risk assessment has to be very forward looking. The other issue, of course, now is the challenging inflation environment and the rapid change in interest rates. We know that that has not yet fully transmitted through to the financial system and onwards through to the real economy in terms of how it will ultimately affect households. And so on. We know there's a further way to go in terms of inflation. So I think in this context, we have to make sure that our supervision is really focused on this sort of dynamic and evolving risk assessment at both a micro and macro level. And we need very good interaction and communication between our sort of micro supervision and our macro supervision.
I'd like to, I hope that's not a provocation, but to ask you more specifically about an individual case, because it's so important and interesting in the context of the war in Ukraine. So there are European Eurozone banks that are still in Russia. And play an increasingly important role in channeling financial flows between Russia and the rest of the world. Raiffeisen has been much in the news, also UniCredit, which is a longstanding and generous member of Bruegel. So how the optics seen from outside of the supervisory process is that European supervisors have been pushing for those banks to leave Russia, and the sooner the better. But that's not happening, at least in some individual cases. So I know you cannot comment on individual cases, and I'm not asking you about that. But what did we learn in that episode? Does that mean that supervisors lack the powers they should have to enforce this kind of situations? What would be your takeaway so far?
So as you say, obviously, I won't comment on individual institutions. But again, I think one of the key takeaways from this is that unexpected things happen. And of course, sometimes maybe they do expose gaps in regulation or gaps in our supervisory toolkit. And that certainly can happen from time to time. I think maybe another key lesson is this issue. I think I touched on it earlier about escalation and how we really get traction on issues. And in fact, if you look back at the reviews that were done in relation to the issues in the US, for example, in relation to SVB, or Credit Suisse, yeah. For example, looking at the Barr report, this issue of really getting traction on the issues that you want to have addressed, I think, is a key feature of that. And what we saw, it's called out in the report on the situation in the US, is that maybe supervisors were overly focused on things to do with process and legal requirements and evidence and so on, as opposed to really focusing on things that were about risk assessment, making sure the action that you wanted to take was actually taken. And I think for me also, having worked in an Irish context and the you know, very significant difficulties that we had in our own domestic financial crisis. Again, one of the key findings there was around this issue that you talk about really making sure that we get concerns or issues addressed, you know, up to and including taking a severe action against firms. In our case at home, for example, taking enforcement action. So this idea of an escalation ladder, an escalation toolkit to make sure that we get the things that we want addressed, I think is very important. Now, an important aspect of that is we are the supervisors, okay? In the end, firms are responsible for the firms that they're running, that they're operating. Their board and management have very serious responsibilities. And so I think we also have to look to the boards and managements of firm in terms of, you know, how they're running their own businesses, how they're addressing the issues that are coming up through the supervision, and how they are making sure that they are also delivering. So I think these issues, again, that are called out a little bit in the issues you mentioned, SVB, the US, Credit Suisse and so on, what we learn about governance within firms and the culture that senior management and board set is also an important issue. And it's certainly something that I think that we think very carefully about at the ECB in terms of our supervision, but also for us domestically in Ireland.
Thank you, Sharon. And another aspect of risk assessment is moving on from this crisis to crisis kind of situation, even though it is linked to the crisis situation, is the impact of the macroeconomic growth outlook on this. And I'm thinking to the macro impact of wages, real estate, and so forth. Nicola, maybe you can shade some light on this.
Well, maybe just, you know, there's a cycle of rate increase. The ECB has raised policy rates, I think, by more than 4 percentage points of late. That pretty quickly, that's has big implications for the financial sector. So we've seen that getting disruptive in the US. In the Eurozone, it hasn't produced obvious disruptive consequences. But can you tell you more about how you think of about interest rate risk, but the related questions about business model risk and how that's playing out in the Eurozone banking sector in general as a member of the ECB supervisory board and also in Ireland, if there is any specific situations there.
Thanks. So first, in relation to the banks, and I think this goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, we cannot be complacent. So certainly the way things played out in the US obviously didn't happen in the same way in the Eurozone. But I think the whole issue of interest rate risk, if you look at, for example, what happened in the UK with the UK gilt crisis and the way that very quickly spilled over into the non-bank sector is another example of how, in some ways, I suppose, the basics of what we know about interest rate risk and how we sometimes have to go back to basics, I think, and it's a really important issue. Now, in terms of the work that we had done in relation to the banks, I mean, even before the sort of repricing and adjustment that we've seen in the monetary policy environment. I think if you look back at either ECB, Central Bank of Ireland, or other Eurozone Central Bank financial stability reports, for example, you will see that this interest rate risk or potential risk of rapid repricing of interest rates was certainly called out in advance. And it was something, I think, from a supervisory point of view, that we already had on the radar as a risk. Of course, when interest rates began to increase, it was something that we put sort of further scrutiny on and looked at more closely in the banks. And I think some information has even been published subsequently about the assessment that we've undertaken. But I think, again, it goes to this point about resilience and being prepared for the unexpected and making sure that we have, whether that's capital buffers, liquidity buffers or other, you know, even operational resilience, if you think about, for example, cyber as a different type of risk. And maybe moving away from the banks a little bit for a minute, if that's OK. And again, non-banks has been a big issue here, I think, at your annual meetings. We have a very big non-bank sector in Ireland, and clearly also this issue of interest rate risk and the wider macroeconomic environment and the uncertainty that's prevailing at the moment has been a significant issue that we've seen there. We saw risks crystallising in that sector in, you know, March 2020, around the time of the so-called Dash for Cash. We saw the UK gilt issue that I mentioned already. So we have a non-bank sector now, I think, that plays a very important role globally. And of course, there are positives and opportunities in that in terms of diversifying risk away from the banking sector and also financing, for example, the green transition. So there are important opportunities there. But I think also it's a sector where there's been very good work done in terms of investor protection and so on. But maybe these wider risks around the interconnections in that sector, the risk of an issue in that sector sort of amplifying or feeding through into the banking sector, into the wider financial system, is something that we really need to think about. You know, and many of us in policymaking circles are working on, you know, thinking about frameworks for regulation and potentially supervision of those firms in terms of how that has to evolve over the coming period.
Well, one other aspect is about the situation in each member state, the European level, which will be an interesting aspect to touch upon. And well, we've seen that sometimes the political situation could be creating circumstances that that impact on the bank system. The recent, I'm thinking, Nicolai, about the recent windfall tax for banks in Italy, for example. But that's just an example. Maybe you want to comment on the impact of things like this. But then I would like to go broader on the specific situations in member states and how those specific situations have to be considered in this conversation.
Yeah, I thought the Italian episode was very interesting because I, and maybe it's, this is a biased way to look at it, but my reading of it was that in the Italian policy community, there is a kind of muscle memory of the time when the government really had a lot of direct influence on the banking sector. And the government wanted the banking sector to do something, for example, pass on higher rates to depositors more quickly than they were doing. Banking sector didn't really do that. They said, you know, we're supervised by the ECB. They want us to be profitable, something like that. And so the government decided they could get their way through a different instrument, that was taxation. And I would be curious, of course, Sharon will be cautious in commenting on a different member state, and that's fit and proper. But I would be curious about her reading of how the introduction of European banking supervision to SSM, the fact that member states no longer have direct influence over the banking sector through supervision, which, let's be honest, has been used also for things that economists call financial repression. The fact that this instrument has been removed prompts governments to seek other avenues to keep a handle on domestic banking, which of course goes against the vision of banking union, but is also very understandable from a political standpoint. So if you want to make any comment on this, Sharon.
Well, maybe the kind of broader comment around that is that, of course, in an environment where you have a banking union, certainly a single supervisor, and indeed actually a single monetary policy as well, it does mean a different dynamic, I think, between your policies at the sort of central level and at the domestic level, including, for example, you know, it's a reason why macroprudential policy, for example, is so important in our case at home in relation to mortgage credit, for, you know, given differences in housing cycles and so on. So I think this issue of a single monetary policy and now a single banking supervision has brought that issue then of how national central banks, or even, as Nicola is describing, national governments deal with local policy issues a little bit more to the fore. And you have to understand that there's a sort of dynamic in relation to that. I won't comment on the specific case, obviously, but I think it is important to think about the lags in relation to monetary policy. So, you know, this tightening cycle that we've seen has been very aggressive, very substantial over a short period of time. And we know that there's a lag before that will feed through into the, you know, all the way through the banks, into the economy and to the wider system. And we know from previous rate hiking cycles that we often see this increase in bank profitability at the beginning of the cycle. And of course, I can understand in the sort of political environment in the middle of a cost of living crisis and so on, that this is something about which there are very significant questions. I do think we have to have a mind to further through the cycle. There is a potential for credit losses, for example, and for individuals to get into difficulty with their loans and so on, and therefore the risk of credit problems ahead and the need for increased provisions. So I think it's not the sort of full picture to look at profitability early in the cycle. And of course, you know, if we want a stable banking system that's resilient, that's through good times, through bad times, we need banks to make profits in a sustainable way, in a way that they can also put away capital for the future. Now, of course, this does cause other potential questions, as you've been discussing with Nicola, in terms of sort of bank profitability overall. But I think at least we need to understand that we have to look through the cycle to the potential for future losses into the future. In the end, though, a bit like I was saying earlier about the responsibility on boards and managements, it's the responsibility of boards and managements to make these commercial decisions about their pricing decisions, how they pass through to deposits or to loans. And I think they have to do that in a way that thinks about, of course, their shareholders and also their customers and how their business is going to evolve in that context.
Thank you. And we are going towards the end of our conversation. But before leaving, we cannot close without a reflection on the future. And I would like to ask you, Sharon, what do you think about the evolution in the banking supervision for the next years, both on regulatory issues and governance issues, from completing the banking union to the Capital Requirements Directive, for example?
Yeah, well, of course, we do our supervision in the context of regulation, and the regulatory environment is very important. You mentioned the completing of banking union. It's also very high on our agenda in terms of European deposit insurance. We know that there are these very important proposals from the Commission around the crisis management and deposit insurance proposal. So I think these are very important issues that we need to make as much progress as we can on now. And of course, if we don't progress all of them, you know, there's still lots of work to do to make sure that we complete all of the pillars of banking union in the way that we set out. Maybe one thing to highlight in terms of this changing nature of the financial system is, of course, banks are very important players in the financial system. But we have seen over the last number of years, you know, some fragmentation, particularly in relation to payments, many new providers coming into the payment space, and of course, competing with banks, which is a positive for customers and competition. But it does mean also that I think there's a very big sort of regulatory and legislative agenda around payments providers and how we regulate and supervise them into the future. We have a quite big payment sector in Ireland as well. And I think we see some, maybe we'd call them growing pains for some of those firms. You know, they've come in, gotten regulated, they have to adjust to operating in a regulatory environment and meeting the standards that's required of them in terms of, for example, safeguarding customers' money and so on. Thinking then about the supervision, I mean, Nicola talked earlier about the Schreppwise Person report and so on. So I think for me, in the end, supervision is around our supervisors who are doing the job every day. They're engaging with the banks or whatever type of firm that they supervise. And we need to make sure that they have the right supports to do this really important work in the public interest, which, as Nicola rightly said earlier, is often done, you know, behind the closed doors of the regulatory relationship. And there are certain things that we can't necessarily always tell the public. So I think it's really important that we support them in that work. They have the right skills, the right tools, the right regulatory framework and the right processes and so on. To be able to get that support. And certainly for me as a member of the supervisory board, I see that working with our supervisors, supporting them into the future, continuing to build on the really fantastic work I think we've done already to build the SSM, really to make sure, I suppose, that we're fit for the next decade and we make sure that we're adaptable and flexible to deliver on what I think is a really important role in the public interest.
Yeah, Sharon just mentioned the centrality of the supervisory board for banking supervision in Europe, and that's been the major change of the last decade. It's also important that there will be a transition there in terms of leadership. So there have been two chairs so far, Daniel Nui initially and then Andrea Enria. And in a few days, the ECB will have to decide who is the next chair. So that will be an important step in the development of that system. But I think beyond banking supervision, it's also important to think of the missing pieces, not just in terms of the incompleteness of banking union. And Sharon rightly mentioned deposit insurance as an area where a lot has to be done still, but also in terms of other aspects of supervision that by law and indeed by treaty, the ECB cannot undertake as of itself. So I'm thinking of a few things that are spaces to watch going forward. There's anti-money laundering supervision, on which there is very important legislation being considered right now and hopefully will be finalized before the end of the current legislative term. And this is transformational because the idea, which is in that legislation to create a new European agency, an AML authority for the European Union, is in a way maybe less fundamental, but still very impactful along the lines that happened for prudential supervision with the creation of the single supervisory mechanism a decade ago. And also, I think a rising theme of market integrity, protection of savers, and customer protection, which straddles the divide between banking and non-banks in the supervision of European capital markets, but where I think the European element of supervision lags far behind in terms of creating an internal market and making sure there's a level playing field, but also a minimum protection of customers and of market participants across the board within the single market. So if I think ahead of the next decade, I think the AML supervisory challenge is on course to being tackled, hopefully. But if we think of protection of savers, of investors, of customers, of financial services, in a way that's the next frontier in terms of something where too much remains to be done to achieve the objectives of single market and fundamentally the protection of people who can be victims of the asymmetries of information that exist in the financial sector. So I would flag that as a very important area to develop.
Thank you to both of you. Unfortunately, we could discuss for much longer, but this is all the time we have for this episode. And I would like to remind our listeners that, as usual, they can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. And would like to remind everyone that we are recording from the Bruegel annual meetings and that everyone can rewatch the sessions of the public program on our website as well. Nicholas, Sharon, thanks a lot for joining this conversation.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Giuseppe, again for this session, but more generally for all your contribution to Bruegel.
Thank you, and thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.